Hey everyone, welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
We have a guest on the line all the way from Toronto. Now, if you've been following us for the last few years, you saw this gentleman at our conference last year speaking on the topic of doctor-assisted suicide. He's a good friend of ours, Dr. Ewan Gollihar. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. It's a real pleasure to join you again, and I just love the work you guys are doing.
The feelings are mutual.
Yeah, for sure. Just for the listeners who might not be very familiar with who you are, do you want to tell us just a little bit about your background?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I'm a physician. I studied medicine at UBC and then moved to Toronto to do training in internal medicine and then critical care medicine. And then I ended up pursuing more of an academic career. So I did a PhD in physiology at the University of Toronto, and now I'm at the university as a clinician scientist. So I dedicate about 20 to 25% of my time to looking after patients in the ICU. And then the remaining 75 to 80% is dedicated to science. So I find it's an incredibly stimulating mix of dealing with medical problems and then trying to solve those problems from a science standpoint. Yeah.
What does a day look like for you, man? Like, walk me through that. First of all, what do you eat for breakfast, man? Are you a coffee drinker? And what does a day in the office look like for you?
So yeah, I'm definitely a coffee drinker. I don't know too many doctors who aren't, because everybody knows that coffee is good for you. And for breakfast, I'd like to mix it up. Sometimes it's cereal, sometimes it's yogurt, sometimes it's bacon and eggs. It's just sort of whatever I'm in the mood for every morning.
Nice. Pretty,
I don't have a good routine that way. But a typical day, it really depends whether I'm on call or not. So the way ICU works is you do a week in the ICU at a time. So I'll go on call on a Thursday morning and be on call until the next Thursday. And during that time, I'll be on call every other night with another attending physician. And we've got a big team of residents and fellows who are at various levels of training who are working with us. So the weeks in the ICU can be quite busy, often 70 to 90 hours, depending on how sick the patients are and so on. But when I'm on service, I'm pretty much completely just doing clinical work. And I do about 10 to 12 weeks a year in the ICU, and then the rest of the time is research. So when I'm on research, it's in the office, writing papers, working on grant applications, and then my area in science is clinical physiology, so we do a lot of bedside studies where we try and understand the mechanisms that drive what happens to patients right in the ICU. So the intensive care unit is sort of my laboratory. That doesn't mean the patients are the guinea pigs, but we definitely learn from what's going on.
I remember you telling me that the focus of your research had been in long-term ventilation care. Is that still where you're specializing?
Yeah, so well, my PhD work was all about how being on a mechanical ventilator affects the breathing muscles, mainly the diaphragm muscle. And we've shown that the changes in the diaphragm occur extremely rapidly after patients get put on a breathing machine. And we just published data showing for the first time that these changes in the muscles actually substantially delay recovery and getting off the ventilator. And for some patients, that can be devastating because it means that not only does it take them long to get out of the ICU, but it takes them a lot longer to recover from being critically ill afterwards. So we're just starting to work now in intervention strategies where we develop new ways of setting the ventilator to try and keep patients breathing and avoid this injury from happening. But it's a really complicated problem, and like anything in science, you answer one question and you discover five more. So it's an exciting area to be working in.
Thank you for all that work that you're doing. Now, for the listeners that might not be familiar with you, you are a Christian too. As a Christian working in this field, you obviously come across some things that may go against your beliefs as well. And one of those things that you talked about, especially for our conference last year, was on doctor-assisted suicide. Now, we're not going to be talking about doctor-assisted suicide directly for the most of this podcast, but for maybe the listeners that are tuning in for the first time, could you tell us briefly what doctor-assisted suicide is and how that might be different from, say, euthanasia?
And maybe some of the other terminologies it goes by.
Sure, sure. So these kinds of terms all fall under the rubric of what's called end-of-life care, where people who are diagnosed with a terminal illness or have a chronic illness that's progressing and it's becoming clear that death is in the foreseeable future, basically will need to have conversations with their doctors about end-of-life care and how best to ensure that they don't suffer as they go through the dying process, and that we optimize their well-being and quality of life. And for a long time, over the last several decades, palliative care became a really important part of the discussion, where it was recognized that rather than constantly just trying to fix problems, we really want to focus on making sure people are comfortable and that we maintain their dignity as they progress towards death. And that means symptom control and even aspects like spiritual concerns, addressing spiritual and existential suffering. Mm. And only relatively recently has physician-assisted death entered the discussion. And physician-assisted death is the umbrella term for a medical act where the intention of the physician is for the patient to die or to end up dead. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of terms that fall within physician-assisted death. One is physician-assisted suicide, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. and the other is euthanasia. And physician-assisted suicide generally refers to when patients ask their physician to end their life and the physician gives them a lethal prescription that the patient administers to themselves. Could be a high dose of a drug, and the patient takes the drug themselves. Euthanasia is the same thing, basically, but simply where the physician or nurse actually administers the drug instead of the patient self-administering. Mm. Both of them are now legal in Canada. The legalization happened, as you know, a couple of years ago. The court decision came down in early 2015. It came into effect in mid-2016, and since then, several thousand Canadians have sought death by physician-assisted means. The kind of current term that people seem to like is medical assistance in dying, or MAID for short. But I find that a lot of these terms, like MAID or physician-assisted death, really don't adequately help people to understand that what makes these actions different from, say, palliative care or withdrawal of life support. And the critical feature is that the doctor is deliberately trying to cause the patient's death. When you give someone a lethal prescription, the treatment goal is death. When you administer euthanasia, you're trying to end the patient's life. And that's really what makes this different from palliative care, where you're not trying to end the patient's life. You're trying to maximize their quality of life as they die. Or even what I do in the ICU quite routinely, where we withdraw life support in patients who won't recover from their severe life-threatening illness, and we just accept that withdrawal life support. But when I do that, my goal isn't to end their life. We're simply discontinuing a futile therapy. Mm-hmm. So it's this distinction of intention that's crucial, and people tend to try to mask that over in order to make it sound more palatable to the general public.
Right. One of the things that you talked about in some of your sessions at our conference last year, one thing that really stuck out was some of the assumptions that are made in the secular community on this issue. Whenever we talk about the issue, it seems to me it's always set up as, you know, you have your religious community that's against it and you have your secular community that's all for it. And it seems that the secular kind of a standpoint is almost taken as a given, right? It's taken for granted. And somehow the religious community needs to bear the burden of proof and actually show why it is wrong to end this person's life, so on and so forth. So can you speak into that a little bit about some of the assumptions that are made in this discussions?
You've hit the nail right on the head. I think this is the fundamental problem with Canadian discourse around this, is that we are juxtaposing a religious view with a secular view, and failing to consider the fact that both of those sets of views are worldviews with specific metaphysical assumptions about the nature of reality. And I think where this becomes most obvious is the assumptions that are made about what it's like to be dead. So the argument for euthanasia turns on the notion that the patient is better off dead. They have irremediable suffering, and above and beyond that, it's meaningless or pointless suffering from the point of view of the patient. And their quality of life is consequently so poor that you are doing them good by killing them. You're doing them good by rendering them non-existent. But this really begs the question of what it's like to be dead. Are you non-existent after death? And what is the quality of life of someone who's dead? What is that like? And it's not as if science has spoken to that issue. It's not as if we have any empirical evidence, mm-hmm. which is generally the secularists' empirical standard or epistemic standard is the what can be observed. So they have really no data to support this claim, but it's essentially a kind of blind quasi-religious faith where you're putting your faith in death mm-hmm. to accomplish some good when you really have no idea what it's like to be dead. And to me, this is what makes it so obvious that this is not a religious versus secularism debate. This is one religion versus another duking it out about what the best way to deal with the existential problem of suffering should be.
We've had another court ruling. The Ontario Divisional Court ruled that the physicians and nurses are required to make effective referrals for abortion and doctor-assisted suicide. Can you kind of take us through that decision and what it means to be have an effective referrals?
Sure, that's a great question. So this, the concerns around referral and handling this issue were generated because around the same time that euthanasia became legal in Canada, the College of Physicians in Ontario, which is the organization that governs physician behavior in Ontario, changed their policy on the management of conscientious objection. And the background that you should understand is that for really since the advent of Canadian medicine, it's been recognized that conscientious objectors in medicine would not be required to participate in or to facilitate ethically controversial procedures for patients. And a good example of this was abortion, which was legalized in the 1980s, but there was never any requirement for physicians to refer for abortion. And at the time, that would have been viewed as an obscene or tyrannical action on the part of the state to require physicians to refer for abortion. And that's why there are so many abortion clinics where women go directly without any referral to seek the services of someone who's willing to perform that action. And at this time around, when euthanasia was legalized, it became clear that powers that be weren't content with a similar arrangement. They really wanted to compel physicians to participate in euthanasia. And the policy that they came down with actually extends to abortion and other ethically controversial services. It really doesn't have to do just with physician-assisted death, but that was sort of the occasion. And it became clear to us who are Christians that we wouldn't be willing to provide this, even to refer for it. So we actually sued the college after a lot of efforts at advocacy and discussion to try and get them to change their mind after speaking with members of provincial parliament and really having no luck, we sought a legal intervention and sued the college saying that this requirement on the part of the college violates our charter rights as Canadian citizens. And unfortunately, when the judgment was handed down in January, the judge ruled against us and acknowledged that the college's stipulation was indeed a severe violation of the charter, but nevertheless was necessary in order to ensure access to quote-unquote health care.
Let's just take a moment to highlight that, Ewan. So what they're saying is that, in fact, you're right. This is a violation of your charter rights as a physician, but that is an acceptable action.
That's correct.
And so why then do they see this as an acceptable, that it's acceptable to violate the rights of the physician, their charter rights?
Well, because from their standpoint, when you accept the responsibilities of caring for patients in the role of physician, you necessarily surrender some of your own freedoms. And there's obviously a sense in which that's true. Once I take on a patient, I have a fiduciary duty to ensure that they're cared for, and that can sometimes interfere with my own convenience. And their argument was that given that a referral is the ordinary way in which patients access healthcare that a primary care physician won't provide, this was necessary in order to ensure access to health care for patients.
Now, what's interesting about that, and I'm wondering if you've looked into this at all, is I've seen that there are other provinces who have that have made provisions for their doctors, whereas Ontario is not making provisions for their physicians. It seems like that's pretty heavy-handed.
It's extremely heavy-handed. And in fact, Ontario and Nova Scotia are the only jurisdictions in the world where euthanasia is legal, where physicians are required to participate by providing an effective referral. So in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in the United States, where physician-assisted suicide is legal in some jurisdictions, none of those require an effective referral, and patients have never seemed to have much trouble getting access. There seems to be a larger ideological point that they want to make here.
That's interesting what you mentioned just now, and I want to highlight that because the argument, it seems to me, hinges on this idea that if we accommodate the freedom of conscience and the religious freedom of the physicians and nurses and whatnot, this would actually hinder access to care. But what you're saying is, well, we're seeing this around the world. That's not the case. Has there been any evidence that was put forward that this in fact inhibits or hinders patients from receiving the care that they need for this particular court ruling?
To be honest with you, I didn't read all the court arguments closely. I do know that on both sides, there was a lot of back and forth about this very issue. And I don't think there really isn't really much data. And this kind of data is always very open to interpretation.
Yeah. Right.
So it really becomes a matter of opinion. Now, I can tell you the Ministry of Health in Ontario actually has created a 1-800 line for people to be able to self-refer. So as part of, in response to some of the lobbying that we did, the ministry actually created a 1-800 line so that people could call and get direct access to someone who is willing to provide euthanasia. So the barriers to access have absolutely been minimized as much as possible. I honestly think that this is really more about an ideological debate. To me, the issue of access, I really think that we should have emphasized this more in the arguments before the court, but the issue of access entirely is entirely predicated on whether what's being requested to access is a good thing to do.
Right.
And there's all kinds of procedures and treatments that patients don't have access to or have access only with great difficulty, and that's generally because the medical community doesn't believe that they offer much benefit for patients or that they're potentially harmful. And a good example of that is the recent debate around venous occlusion in multiple sclerosis. And there was an Italian surgeon, you may remember this in the news a few years ago, where an Italian surgeon was doing this procedure, opening up some of the large central veins in the head and around the brain. And this was supposedly a miraculous intervention for multiple sclerosis. And the medical community in Canada stood up and said, you know what, there's zero evidence for this, and we're not doing it. And Canadian patients were going to Central America, they were going to Europe to get this done. And of course, ultimately, the evidence really vindicated the medical community. So the question of whether access should be provided is totally predicated on whether this is the right thing to do. And just because it's legal doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. That's not a justification for a medical intervention. And this really sidesteps the entire debate about whether euthanasia is morally justifiable and whether the claim that being killed can be good for you is at all defensible. So to me, the access question, it's important to think about, but it's a secondary issue.
One of the things that I find disturbing and frustrating on this, Ewan, and I'm wondering your thoughts on this, and that is you also see an ideological thrust in that. How much has Canada put into palliative care versus, and you know, the money and effort that have they put into palliative care versus the work that they put into euthanasia and making that accessible? You know, I think it's interesting in Canada that everyone has access to euthanasia, but I don't think that we all have access to palliative care. And I think that that's interesting, where as a society, what it shows are where our values are at on the one hand. But then on the other hand, with what you're getting at, Ewan, and I've seen this in Canada, and maybe this is the cynic part in me coming out, but you see this heavy-handedness towards any other worldview other than secularism, that you're allowed to be a Christian when you go home, Ewan, but when you come to the office, you're not allowed to bring that Christianity, you know, with you to the office. And really what we're seeing in Canada is this divide happening where we're seeing the limitations being put on how you can actually practice this out. So those are two ideologies, I think, that are taking place here. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's absolutely the crux of the problem. Secularists, and I use that with a capital S, and not just because it was the first word in the sentence. The secularists have deceived themselves into believing that in a pluralistic society, an atheistic position is the default.
Yep.
And I think a lot of people have fallen for this notion. Even a lot of Christians sort of naturally think that beginning with God is somehow more biased than beginning without God. And the reality is that this beginning without God in your process of moral reasoning will lead you to very different conclusions than beginning with God. And there's no, and if you're committed to pluralism, where every worldview is treated with equal respect and weight, and you don't try to apply any universal standard to distinguish between them, then you are in no position to say whether you should begin with or without God. But if you read the literature that gets published in support of euthanasia, and indeed the Royal Society of Canada end-of-life expert report that was issued several years ago, they're very honest about the fact that they begin their reasoning without reference to God because they don't feel there's sufficient evidence in support of God's existence. And more importantly, in a pluralistic society, you can't begin with God. You have to begin based on human autonomous reason. So I disagree with both of those claims that they made, but they don't try to defend them. They just state them and proceed from there. So underlying all this is a lot of really lazy, erroneous philosophy. And I think people don't have insight into their own basic philosophical presuppositions. And the challenge is to find a voice to make people revisit these assumptions. That's what's so hard.
Do you think, like, again, this is the cynic in me coming out, but do you think money is a part of this, though? It seems to me that euthanasia is a lot cheaper than palliative care.
You know, Andy, I honestly don't think that's a driver. I honestly don't think so. I certainly haven't seen any evidence of that in Canada.
That's fair.
From the physicians I know who provide physician-assisted death, money and finances has never been a motivation from a systemic standpoint. Like, Ontario blows money in all sorts of healthcare interventions despite our massive debt. And so I don't see that concern about finances being the major issue. No, they certainly recognize that it is a cheaper option. In fact, the Ontario government, I don't know if other provincial ministries did this, but the Ministry of Health in Ontario has made euthanasia medications available for free. I still think that that's related to a twisted understanding of what compassion at the end of life means.
So you see this as much more ideologically driven?
Yeah, it's totally a function of someone's philosophy and their understanding of how you help someone who's dying and who sees their suffering as pointless.
When we think about this issue, we always often think Christians against the culture kind of thing. But this includes a lot of other medical professionals from other faiths. Do you see everybody from different faiths working together in this aspect? Because there's a number of other rulings across Canada where everybody's kind of come together and worked together on this.
Yeah, there definitely has been some cooperation between faiths. The Coalition for Healthcare and Conscience in Canada, which is an umbrella organization advocating around these issues, includes Jews and Muslims in the umbrella organization. It's interesting to me just to note that there's been relatively little outcry from the Muslim community. I might have expected more around this issue, and I'm not exactly sure why that is. And I think part of it might be that I'm just not that connected to that community, so I'm not aware of all the discussions that are going on. But there's no question that in this conversation, the most outspoken people have been Catholics, Orthodox Jews, and evangelicals. So there has been good cooperation around this issue across different belief systems.
Now, with this sort of ruling coming down, how do physicians and nurses work around this issue? One option that I heard of, I don't know if this is something that's being done across Canada or anything like that, but one option that I heard was to refer to a counselor instead. So then the patient will talk with the counselor and then decide whether they're going to go through with doctor-assisted death or not. Have you seen this sort of thing being done? What are some other ways in which doctors and nurses might try to work around this issue?
Yeah, so this is now the challenge. There's going to be some variability, I think, in what people are willing to do. The basic reason for a refusal to provide an effective referral is that providing an effective referral makes you morally complicit in the action. Mm-hmm. So if someone came to you and said, "Hey, I want to buy drugs," and you said, I don't sell drugs, but go talk to my friend over there who does sell drugs. He can help you out. You know, that probably doesn't qualify you as a drug dealer, but you're certainly morally complicit in that person's getting access to drugs. Mm-hmm. And if someone came to you and said, "Hey, I want to end my own life," and you said, "I don't know exactly how to do that, but I have a friend who can give you some instructions," and you send them to that friend, knowing that he or she will provide the instructions, you're complicit in that person's act of suicide if they follow through. And so for us, the question is, how do we manage this in a way that we take good care of the patient, we remain very committed to making sure they're well cared for, but we do not make ourselves morally complicit. And that judgment around complicity is probably what's going to drive some variability. So there may be some who might be comfortable referring to something like a counselor or to an intermediate party. So that, this is what drives the variability. But people are now facing this issue down. But I can tell you, there's a lot of very brave people who absolutely will not refer or provide access to this procedure, and they are more than prepared to face whatever consequences because they see so strongly that that would be the wrong thing to do.
Speaking of consequences, from what I understand currently, there are no consequences in place for not participating, but I'm sure given time that those would be put in place. Have you heard of anything?
So the way the consequences would follow would be a standard disciplinary action by the college. So if a patient made a request and it was declined and they couldn't get a referral, some patients would just say whatever and go find somebody else. But if they're sort of an activist type patient, they might be really upset and lodge a formal complaint with the college. And then the consequences begin. So you are going to have formal hearings before the college for them to determine whether you did indeed violate college policy. And just participating in the hearing costs several thousand dollars a day. So there's an immediate financial cost. And then they may require you to stop practicing for some time. They may revoke your license altogether. It's not exactly clear just what they would do or how aggressive they'll be. But given their commitment to pursuing this course, I would expect them to prosecute fairly vigorously.
I've read also that there's a number of academic papers, and this goes a little bit further, I guess. They're calling for removing of all conscience rights in medicine, as well as screening out medical school candidates. That seems pretty extreme, but is that the way it's heading somewhat? Do you see it going that way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are a number of very vocal and influential individuals, and I'm not going to name names, who have a very strong philosophically driven agenda around reducing doctors and nurses to mere technicians. And what underlies this agenda is, I think it's a kind of moral relativism where it's seen as very wrong for one individual to tell another individual that what they want is morally unacceptable.
The irony there is immediate.
Of course. Of course. It is. It's all over what they're trying to do, of course.
Right.
But where this comes in the context of the patient-doctor interaction, you know, traditionally the doctor's aim has been to do the patient good while respecting patient autonomy. And that means we don't force patients to undergo treatments that they don't want. But this way of looking at things extends patient autonomy to actually define what counts as good. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to tell someone that what they want is not good for them, then that's paternalistic. That's imposing your moral views on them and violates patient autonomy. And this is behind the agenda that seeks to make doctors and nurses sort of unthinking technicians who provide services. Indeed, the kind of cool current term for referring to healthcare professionals is providers.
Interesting. So really what I sense from you is this idea of kind of very, very much dehumanizing the medical profession. Is that what I'm hearing from you with regards to referring to physicians as technicians?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way of putting it that I hadn't thought about before. I would say it is dehumanizing in some respects to be treated as if your moral convictions have no place in guiding your own actions. Absolutely, that's dehumanizing.
Well, I guess the angle I was kind of thinking from was what we're seeing then is viewing the physician is very mechanical in what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
And really kind of losing that human interaction between, well, first of all, respecting that the physician is a human being and those that they are seeking to help are human beings. It's interesting that you kind of see this moral shift happening where the rights of the doctor, and they've stated this, is less than the patient, that the patient trumps the doctor in this way.
Yeah, exactly. They're really not viewed as equal partners in the endeavor. And there's a lot going on behind there. It's a shift in what medicine means, what the goal of medicine is. And you're picking up on something important, I think, that you can't do this without changing the nature of the patient-physician interaction. You know, part of, if you want people who are compassionate and concerned and self-sacrificing, they need to be devoted to the patient's good and not merely to doing what the patient wants.
And I think this is something that our state doesn't really fully appreciate, is how those moral convictions follow from their religious convictions, which is just seeking to affect the good of that patient.
Yeah, well, I think this is part and partial of the general cultural view of religion as a kind of superstition that one happens to hold but could not possibly give actual reasons for, which is why apologetics is so important in this day and age, because we need to restore the cultural respect for religion as a thinking person's prerogative. Mm-hmm. And, of course, religion in general may be irrational. I think Christianity is the only rational religion, but the point is that the culture seems to assume that as soon as you say a belief is religious, that it can't possibly be connected in any way to a truth standard. Mm-hmm.
Time is quickly running away from us. As we wrap up, I'm just curious, what's the next move for pro-life physicians and nurses? Is this court decision going to be appealed? Have you heard anything about that?
Yeah, my understanding is that the plan is to appeal the decision, and I'm not exactly sure of the timing of that. I think they're moving forward quickly, but I think we all feel a sense of pessimism about the chances of having the ruling overturned, given that the same ideological bias seems to affect judges pretty consistently. And pretty much every decision related to end-of-life care that I can think of in Ontario in the last 10 years, and indeed from the Supreme Court, has been weighted in favor of patient autonomy. So we'll continue to pursue this. We're also hoping for a legislative solution. And I think if there could be political change in Ontario, there may be some interest in passing laws that would protect the conscience of individual physicians. So we're waiting to see how that goes as well. Currently, the Coalition for Healthcare and Conscience is running a campaign called the Campaign for Conscience. It's running in Ontario in March, and hopefully we'll be in BC soon, but this is where churches and Christians are invited to contact their political representatives to try and speak out and make their views known that this is unacceptable. And And I hear rumors of same kinds of issues going on in BC where,
yes,
I think recently the head of palliative care at a Fraser Valley Hospice resigned because they were going to be required to provide euthanasia, and it's definitely an important concern for British Columbians.
One of the things that I have become more and more convinced of is encouraging Christians to participate in this political process, but as well seeking to inspire our young people to see the need and the importance to get involved in politics.
Yeah, totally. Maybe I'll just make a comment on that. What we think we need is a in the same way that we've seen a major revolution in philosophy, in metaphysics. I think of Alvin Plantinga and William Lane Craig and all these prominent philosophers who are Christians who've really helped shift the dialogue. We really need a generation of Christian political philosophers to help us to think about how to manage these kinds of conflicts between worldviews in the public square and what exactly a Christian way of dealing with this issue is, because I don't know, would it now be the Christian thing to do to make euthanasia illegal, or should we simply allow people to act according to their worldview? These are the kinds of political questions that I wrestle with that I'm not sure of the answers to, and maybe that sounds almost heretical to put it that way.
No, I understand what you're saying. They're difficult issues.
Yeah, and we need hard-thinking, smart Christians to help us address these issues.
All right. Thank you so much, Ewan, for joining us on this show. And for those listeners that are interested, we actually interviewed Ewan a couple of years ago on the issue of doctor-assisted suicide. So we'll put that up on our show notes. Make sure you check that out because we go a little deeper into that particular issue there.
And I also did an interview with MP Harold Albrecht on this issue, who was also one of the MPs that was fighting this bill. So the eugenics bill. So you can also check that out.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more stuff to think about. Ewan, again, thank you so much for joining us on this show.
My pleasure. Thanks to all of you.